I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. There's been a lot of discussion about contagion with the global spread of coronavirus. Today, we're going to talk about a different kind of contagion, behavioral contagion, the underappreciated power of peer pressure and how it can shape society's response to dangers and threats. Our guest, economist Robert Frank, has written a book, Under the Influence, that explores how seemingly small individual acts can have a big impact on others. He uses climate change as an example. While there's a need for strong regulations to reduce harmful emissions, changing personal behavior can have a multiplier effect, kind of like a virus. It's easy to feel overwhelmed and helpless when faced with so many crises, which is why we asked Robert Frank to be our guest today on Radio Times. He's the Henrietta Johnson Lewis Professor of Management, Professor of Economics at Cornell University's Johnson School of Management. And Robert Frank, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Marty, what a pleasure.
Nice to have you with us. We have a lot to talk about. Let me just pick your brain as a longtime economist. Have we ever faced an economic crisis on this scale because of a public health crisis?
We have not. And in my lifetime, we've never faced anything like the kind of disruption that we've seen just in the last couple of months. I think the Great Depression was the closest rival to the current upheaval, but I think in the end, this is going to be even bigger than that.
In fact, in April, 20 million people applied for unemployment, essentially meaning that 20 million people lost their jobs in 1 month alone. And we know that millions more people in May have also applied for unemployment benefits. Are we looking at another depression?
It's starting to look more and more like we are. The official unemployment rate just announced last week was almost 15%, but the Labor Department revealed that because of a coding error, the true figure is closer to 20%. And I think nobody expects that to go down in the months ahead. We're in for a very long, tough slog.
Well, as we know, and I know from talking with you and other economists, that it's consumer spending. I think it's about 70% of the U.S. economy. That has been a driver of our economy. And now we either have people who don't have money to spend because they don't have a job, or maybe they have a job, but they don't know where to spend their money. How should we think about consumer spending under these circumstances?
Consumer spending is fallen enormously for the reasons you just described, but it's not just consumer spending. Now, because states have balanced budget requirements, they're not collecting anything like the tax revenue that they normally do. They are beginning to lay off essential workers, firefighters, police, teachers, and others. And we're going to see a fall in government employment. That's another big sector of the economy. There are business investment decisions to be made. Why would you invest if you already have way more than enough capacity to serve the reduced demand that's out there? So from every quarter, we're being hit. And I think if the government acts smart in the wake of all this, we could get things back to normal more quickly than many fear, but I think it's going to take a massive government response to get this back to normal.
What is smart from your perspective? What would be a smart response?
Well, Winston Churchill famously said, never waste a good crisis. And so I think now is a moment to take stock and ask, have we been spending our resources in the wisest possible way? And I think clearly, the answer to that question, if you think even briefly about it, is no. We're facing not only the viral threat. We knew that was going to come. We did not stockpile. We did not build surge capacity. We did not plan accordingly. But an even bigger threat is the slower acting and less immediate seeming one from the climate crisis. And we know that if we don't take radical action to deal with that, we're going to see an even bigger set of losses than we're seeing under the COVID epidemic. So, yes, it's a very good time to reassess how we spend our money. And going forward, it's a good opportunity to say, well, maybe we really ought to be investing more in vaccine research and hospital surge capacity and protective equipment. Maybe we ought to be investing more heavily in green energy and an infrastructure that's prepared to deliver green energy to the economy as a whole, we could do those things. It's a question of our will to do them.
Well, it's clear that the people want to get back to work, whether it's individuals that want to get back to work or governors, or certainly the president wants us to get back to work. But it seems, you know, until we can have enough testing and then tracing of contact tracing, we're kind of flying blind here.
That's what the experts keep telling us, that it's not safe to go back until we have mechanisms in place to immediately track down new cases as they emerge. And so, yes, I think we're about to conduct a very dangerous experiment. We're sending people back out into the marketplace, and there are going to be infections, and we don't have in place the apparatus that we need in order to be able to trace and contain them. So, yeah, it's a scary time in the weeks ahead.
Because on the one hand, there's that, you know, wanting to get back to work and wanting to do it now, but it takes time to develop vaccines, to have tests that we know are reliable.
Right. There's been a new test approved, a saliva-based test. If that test can be brought to scale and made widely available, that's a hopeful sign. There is hope that we'll have a vaccine by year's end. I think the probability of that is way less than half, according to the people who had the most experience with this. But That could be a break. We might come up with a treatment. There are several promising options there. So there are some things that could spell good news in the months ahead, but none of it's certain.
I heard in an interview you have a son who's an EMT. Is that right?
Yes, my youngest son is an EMT here in Ithaca. Thankfully, they're all healthy so far, but you know, it's inevitable they'll be exposed to heavy loads of this, and we're hoping for the best, yes.
I mean, there's so many people, it's a cliche to say on the front line, but there's so many people like your son who are on the front line fighting, you know, not just fighting the epidemic, but trying to protect us from the epidemic.
And it makes it especially nettlesome that the government, especially at the federal level, is not taking every step available to it to help get us through this. Yeah, that's a very worrisome thing for all of us.
Let me ask you about contagion or peer pressure. And I remember seeing a picture over the weekend of a restaurant. I'm not sure where it was. And they opened up for business. And there were people without face masks and certainly within, you know, shoulder to shoulder of each other. And it was pretty clear that from their perspective, and I believe the restaurant was shut down, might have been in Colorado. From their perspective, they didn't need to do or wear any of these protective measures. Help us understand peer pressure under this pandemic.
You know, what you feel you should do or need to do depends so heavily on what people around you do. Here in Ithaca, New York, we're kind of a progressive, isolated community. It's very unusual to see people on the street here without masks. If the mayor declared the community open tomorrow, I'm not sure anybody would do anything differently from what they're doing now, just because I think people are still quite worried that we're not prepared to remingle. So, yeah, I think the fact that the leaders of the country are not wearing masks, the fact that they're in statements in public expressing disdain for people who wear masks, that's been a very damaging set of examples that we've had to witness.
But part of your book is about the fact that, yes, government has a job to do and they need to do that job, but that as individuals, that our behavior can truly affect other people's behavior. Using the mask as an example of that, are we more likely to follow what Fauci says or what Trump says versus what our neighbor says or does?
You know, I think both of those matter. People trust Fauci. He's been experienced fighting disease for many decades. He's an established scientific figure. The tragedy of all this is that the civilian leadership of the government is giving advice that runs contrary to what the scientific community is giving. Now, be humble. Recognize that this is a new virus. We don't know all the details of how it's transmitted and what's safe and what's not safe. But I think in a situation of such uncertainty as we're facing now, the cautious approach is the one that stands out as the right one, and we don't seem to be taking that.
Yeah, but are we more likely to wear a face mask if we are outside and we see other people wearing a face mask?
Oh, of course. And if people are wearing masks and they see others who don't, and they kindly ask the ones who aren't wearing masks, my wife and I were on a walk a couple of days ago and said to three young men, we'd be grateful if you'd wear masks when you're walking on this trail. They didn't get angry. They responded politely. I don't know if they'll wear masks, but it doesn't hurt to speak up. There's some research now showing that if you speak up, people are much more receptive than you imagine that they will be. Not always, but on balance, that seems to be true.
Better than shaming them?
Yeah, I think shaming is counterproductive. People become defensive. That it makes them more likely to want to do the opposite of what you'd like to see them do. So I think if you ask politely, could you wear a mask? The point of the mask is not to protect you, it's to protect others. And it's just a courtesy.
We're almost having a break here, but I'm also thinking of what we call enlightened self-interest. The idea is that you do something for your own benefit, but it also has a benefit for the community at large.
Yeah, we have a very narrow conception of self-interest sometimes. I think the idea that you look out for number one, and if it's not immediately beneficial to you, you give it less than your full attention. I think that misses the point that we are in a society where if you can't cooperate effectively with others around you, you can't function effectively. We're long past the day when a single practitioner could succeed. The real success today comes in collaborative teams. And so if you think only about your own interest, why would a member of a highly functioning team want to have you as a team member? They can do better than that.
And it's interesting what we're dealing with now, whether it's climate change or the pandemic, it's really a global issue. It's not a national issue or a neighborhood issue.
Right. But it's also a neighborhood issue. In your opener, you talked about the tendency of individuals to take individual action and then face criticism because that's known not to be enough to solve the problems that we face. Mm-hmm. So unless we have a robust national program of investment in green energy, we really won't solve the climate dilemma. And so if you're an individual and you walk instead of drive, if you eat meat a little less often, I'm an economist. I was often among the critics of those so-called acts of conscious consumption. Yeah. They make you feel good, but they don't solve the problem. In the course of working on my book,
you know what, Robert, Frank, hold on.
My mind about that.
Fair enough. I want to pick up on that after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowanen.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Our guest is Robert Frank. He's a professor of management and economics at Cornell University. And we're talking about his new book. It's called Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. And he says it's time to take a look at peer pressure and see how it can influence not only our behavior in our neighborhood, but have even larger effects than that. We want to hear from you, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499, and we want to know what you think. Robert Frank, right before the break, you were indicating that you're kind of a convert to this idea of peer pressure. Help us understand this transformation you went through.
So the standard economist's objection to taking individual steps to reduce your carbon footprint are that first, selfish people tend not to do those things because the benefit's so small that they don't see whether it matters. And also, the problems are so big that even if everybody did take the steps we're talking about, so driving less often, eating meat less often, putting solar panels on your rooftop, even if people did take those steps, it would be too small an impact to really solve the scale of the problem that we face. The reason I've changed my mind about that skepticism, really there are two reasons. One is that when you do one of these actions, when you take a step to reduce your carbon footprint, it's true that the individual direct effect of that is very small. You could say negligible, mm-hmm. but that's not the end of the story. What we know from one of the early studies of solar panel adoption, for example, is that if somebody early in the cycle would put on a rooftop solar installation, and it would be more effective if it were on the street side of the house rather than around back where others couldn't see it, then within 4 months' time, on average, there'd be another installation caused by people seeing that first one. It was a complicated set of steps statistically to separate whether the new one was caused by the first one, but researchers can do that. Then that one would spawn another new installation in 4 months' time on the average. The first one would keep on doing. So after 4 months, you've got two. After 8 months, you've got four. After a year, you've got eight. After 2 years' time, that one random installation at the beginning of the cycle ended up giving you 32 sets of solar panels. And it doesn't stop in the zip code. I mean, each of these people has relatives somewhere else they talk to, and they install solar panels as a result of that first and subsequent installations. And it creates an enormous impact compared to the effect of just what you do. But that's just the small effect. The main effect of you're doing these things is that it changes who you are. It changes you from somebody who thinks only in terms of your own narrow interest to somebody who's more focused as what we might call a climate advocate. And as you become more of a climate advocate, you're more likely to vote for politicians who will enact the carbon fee and dividend systems and the green investment portfolios that we need to adopt. You're more likely to donate money to their campaigns, knock on doors to help them get elected. So it's really not at the expense of the policies we need to adopt. You can really view these individual actions as steps that help us get to the policies that we need to adopt.
Let me pick up on a couple of things. Is it because, I mean, you talked about trustworthiness. So if I have a neighbor who puts, let's say, solar panels on his or her house, but I really like them versus if I don't like them at all, we've had all sorts of neighborly problems. Does that affect people's behavior at all?
You know, they're in a polarized era. Sometimes you see somebody do something, they're on the other team, it makes you want to do the opposite of what they did. So yes, that is potentially a problem. When, for example, Al Gore would announce that a new study showed that warming was proceeding faster than we realized, people who were denying that climate change was a problem got even more hardened in their determination to resist taking any steps to try to parry any kind of climate threat that we face. So yes, that can be a problem. But on balance, when you see other people and large numbers of other people taking actions, that kindles within us an almost irresistible urge, at least to investigate whether it might make sense for us to do it too. We each of us know very little about the details of life out there in the world. Other individuals are ignorant, too, but together people know quite a bit. And when we see groups of people taking action, if you didn't have an impulse at least to investigate whether maybe you ought to be doing that, too, you'd probably be ill-equipped to make your way in the world.
I read there's a shorthand for fear of missing out, FOMO. I mean, the idea is,
yes, exactly.
Hey, what's going on here and how do I get a piece of this?
Yeah, that's one of the big motives for action in this world. You see others doing something. Somebody asked me to describe the most vivid example of peer pressure that I've ever seen. And to this day, it remains a scene from an Alan Funt film. Alan Funt, you'll remember, is the
Canberra impresario.
Right. He announces this great job. It pays an enormous salary. There's no burdensome requirements. So, of course, a lot of people want to interview for it. He invites them in. So we see a candidate show up for his interview. They show him into a waiting room. There are already four people sitting there waiting. We, the film viewer, know that they're Confederates of Alan Funt, but the subject doesn't know that. So the film goes on about its business. It keeps coming back. They're sitting there quietly. Finally, we see a close-up of the subject's face. He's impassive as ever, but then he gets agitated, and the camera pans back and shows that the reason he's agitated is that the other four have, at no apparent signal, stood up and are taking off all their clothing. And he gets more and more worried looking, but then you see him tip, and the scene ends. He's stood too and takes off all his clothing. They're all naked standing there waiting for what comes next. You know, you're sure you wouldn't do that if you were in that situation. I was sure I wouldn't, but you have to think about it from the subject's perspective. You know, he's the last one to arrive. He doesn't know what's going on. The others, if anybody knows, it's they who know. They think it's worth doing, and it's a very powerful impulse to do what the people who seem to know what they're doing are doing.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Robert Frank. He's an economist, a professor of management at Cornell University, and we're talking about his new book. It came out just a couple months ago, Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. And again, you can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Well, from getting naked to electric bills, part of your book, you talk about when electric bills are sent out, and if your bill is compared to your neighbor's bill, that actually can change someone's behavior.
That seems to be the most effective intervention that the utilities have come up with yet. If they tell you that you're in the bottom group in terms of efficient electric usage in your area, then that information has a bigger impact on your subsequent attempts to conserve energy than anything else they've discovered.
Wow.
If they tell you you're ahead of the group, some of those people feel like they can ease up, but even that group uses less when they're told that they're ahead of the average. They want to beat the average by even more than they've been beating it.
Is that because we're competitive, or we're just social creatures? We want to know what other people are doing?
You know, I think Charles Darwin's great insight was that life is graded on the curve. It's not how smart you are, how fast you are. It's how your skills compare with the people you're competing against. And so I think, yes, we do have a deep impulse to ask ourselves periodically, how am I doing? And if you don't have a frame of reference, you can't even think about a question like that. And the natural frame of reference typically is, how am I doing compared to people like me? And it's a very powerful stimulus to action.
But you have to feel that that you're part of a group in order to feel that, don't you?
You know, there's hardly anybody on the planet that isn't meaningfully a part of some group. Right. You don't get resources by having them rain down out of the sky. You've got to join a group, perform some task, cooperate with others, and decisions are made about you day after day. Oftentimes, the question of whether you're promoted to the job you want depends less on how well you did in any absolute sense, but on how well you did compared to the other candidates who they might promote. So, yeah, at bottom, the world is a fairly competitive place, but at the same time, we're not likely to succeed if we can't put self-interest aside enough to be reliable as partners in ventures where trust is really required.
Let me read an email from Jen, and this is when we were talking earlier about just how to navigate social distancing and things like wearing masks. She says, I found people whom I've talked to about maintaining social distance to be rude, loud, physically threatening. I've used Ms. Manner's suggestion of, quote, I think we should be farther apart. I've also said something along the lines of, have you noticed the arrows on the floor indicating one-way aisles in supermarkets and have been met with complaint? I mean, it is tricky just to get to back to that earlier part of our conversation. It is tricky to navigate these spaces when we're all under so much stress and trying to figure out, you know, which aisle is the right direction or not.
Yeah, and here's where I think leaders could be much more helpful. You know, I think there's, in the U.S. in particular, there's a very strong, you're not the boss of me mentality. We really value our ability to do what we want when we want to do it. And I think it's really incumbent on leaders to remind people that, yes, you can do whatever you want. The country is founded on the idea of maximum individual freedom. But as John Stuart Mill wrote over a century ago in On Liberty, this is the very most eloquent champion of individual freedom the West has ever known. He said, the only legitimate reason for the government to tell you you can't do what you want to do is to prevent you from causing harm to others. It's not for your own good. It's not because it would be right for you not to do what we're telling you not to do. It's to prevent you from harming others. And what's clear is that close contact during a pandemic puts others at grave risk. There's no if, and, or but about that. That's known to be true. And so I think we need to just remind people that, yes, you have a right to do whatever you want as long as you don't cause undue harm to others. And mingling beyond the safe distances is putting others at risk.
Well, that reminds me of how you write about smoking. And certainly a couple generations ago, most people were smokers. I was one. I read that you started smoking at 14. So did I. And it was completely about peer pressure. But as we know, you cannot smoke in most buildings in this country. Buying cigarettes is extremely expensive at this point. How do you see the role of peer pressure when it came to smoke and things like secondhand smoke?
You know, there's no parent I've ever met, I'm guessing you haven't met one either, who has ever said, I hope my kids grow up to be smokers. Knowing what we know now, that would be just utterly bizarre. And as you just note, that in an environment where most teenagers are smoking, that's very likely, no matter what you do as a parent, no matter how hard you try to emphasize the folly of smoking, it's very likely that your kids will become smokers in an environment like that. That's the environment I started smoking in at age 14. Most of my friends have been smoking already a year or two. Yeah. And most men in the country smoked then. None of my four adult sons is a smoker. And the reason they're not a smoker is not that I did a great job as a parent. I tried best I could to encourage them not to smoke, but they didn't smoke because their friends didn't smoke. That was the short answer. It's a huge effect. If your daughter's friends are 20% smokers and that figure jumps to 30%, she's 25% likely to become or remain a smoker. There's no other effect that's remotely that big. And so what do? We finally intervened against smoking. Most parents would rather raise their kids in an environment where there weren't very many smokers, better able to achieve their goal of raising non-smoking kids in environments like that. And we taxed cigarettes, as you point out. We said you can't smoke in public spaces in many jurisdictions, bars, restaurants. No, you can't smoke there either. We made it less convenient and more expensive. But the reason we did that, the reason we offered for doing that, was that there were new studies coming out of Japan showing that now exposure to secondhand smoke caused serious illness. And it's true, it does. But the harm from secondhand smoke exposure, if you don't work in a crowded bar on a 10-hour shift, is minuscule compared to the harm from actually being a smoker, number one. But even if you want to say it's not the government's job to protect you against harming yourself, the greatest harm you do if you become a smoker is to make other people more likely to smoke. And there is a statistical certainty that many millions of parents will not succeed in raising their kids to be non-smokers if there is an environment in which most other kids are smoking. That by itself is a perfectly legitimate reason for discouraging people from smoke. I call it a behavioral externality. The way you behave affects the social environment that bounces back on us and affects how we behave. Nobody takes that into account individually because the effect of any individual on the environment is so small. But the theme of the book is that the social environment is, in the aggregate, the consequence of the individual choices we make. And if there were any practical way to encourage us to act as if we cared about how our choices affect the social environment, why not think about adopting policies of that sort? And it turns out once you start looking, there are a host of them.
It's also about identity, too. We can now say, well, we're non-smokers. I mean, it's part of our identity. We went through that phase and we came out the other side.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's what qualities do we celebrate? You know, so we were talking earlier about the identity of a climate advocate. You know, the economists, my fellow professionals assume people come into the world with ready-formed identities and preferences. But as Aristotle emphasized, no, that's not the way it works at all. We gradually become who we are. And so if we can point behavior in productive directions, we will become the kind of people who will influence one another to achieve better outcomes in our lives. That's a very simple point, but it's one we've not begun to think seriously about so far.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And if you're just joining us, Robert Frank is our guest. We've had him on the show a couple of times. He's written several books, The Economic Naturalist, Success and Luck. And his new one is called Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. And he's a professor of management and economics at Cornell University. And you can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, how you think this applies to you? We'd love to hear from you. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Hawaii in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Robert Frank about his new book, Under the Influence. It's about behavioral contagion, the power of peer pressure. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Here's an email from Paul. He says, it's known that Fox News is the most watched TV network. They support Trump. They deny global warming. They promote conspiracy theories. Is there any way to combat this effectively? Robert Frank?
Yeah, I think it is well documented that people do take a lot of their information about the world from the news sources that they watch. And here, I think one of the most disturbing studies I've read in recent years was one that analyzed the responses to two particular Fox primetime programs. One was hosted by Tucker Carlson, the other by Sean Hannity. And for a period of weeks, they had very divergent messages about the need to take the COVID-19 virus seriously. Carlson was trying to urge the president to take it more seriously than he was taking it, and was very well connected to the scientific advice about keeping distance and the like. Hannity was saying that the virus was a hoax, mm-hmm. and that people should think of it as no more serious than the ordinary flu virus. And the authors of the study ingeniously were able to identify parts of the country where, in some parts, Tucker got the biggest ratings on the evening Fox News broadcast, and in other parts of the country, it was Hannity, and the people in the Hannity-heavy areas were much more likely to become infected with the virus than in the Tucker.
Wow.
So, yes, it's a huge effect on people, and at least in that one specific way, we know it's a pernicious effect. And how do you combat that? That's a very important question. You know, how do you combat misinformation on Facebook? That's not any less important of a question, and these are things we're going to have to wrestle with going forward. Maybe there's just nothing you can do, but it's at least a problem that we ought to be thinking seriously about.
I mean, as an economist, it seems you're as much versed in psychology as economic theory, but there is a thing called confirmation bias, which is we tend to seek out the information that reinforces what we believe in the first place.
We're not good scientists by nature, yes. We look for proof of what we already believe, and that's not a good way to make progress in your thinking, but it's something you have to fight to overcome, absolutely.
Let me toss something else out that you write in your book, and this has to do with taxes. And I have a very crowded desk here at home, and I'm putting your book in front of me. And you talk about what you call the mother of all cognitive illusions related to taxes. Walk us through that.
Okay, if we wanted to spend society's resources differently, let's suppose we did. So one proposal would be to take the climate crisis seriously and invest heavily in green energy. Another would be take the threat of future pandemics seriously, invest in hospital surge capacity and medical research and vaccine to it. Those steps would be very expensive. We would need to pay for them. Mm-hmm. Where would we get the money to pay for them? We would have to raise taxes on somebody. We would not be able to get the money to pay for them if we raise taxes on poor people and middle-income people. Those people are already struggling. Where the money is at the top. So to pay for those things, it would require higher taxes on people at the top of the income ladder. Those people, by and large, have lobbied for lower taxes, not higher taxes. They have opposed very strongly any step to raise their taxes. And I think the reason they're doing that is because they have fallen victim to what I'm calling in the book the mother of all cognitive illusions. They're not worried that higher taxes would make it hard for them to buy what they need. Nobody's got a tax proposal that would do that. What they're worried, I think, is that they wouldn't be able to buy the special extras that they want. And what we know about those things, so maybe it's a penthouse apartment with a sweeping view of the city, those are things there aren't enough of to go around. And how do you get them? You get them by outbidding other people like you who also want them. And what people don't realize is that when their taxes go up, yes, they'll have less money to spend. And the times they can remember when they had less money to spend were all unhappy times. But there's never been a time in a prosperous family's lifetime when its taxes have gone up. They've gone down steadily since World War II. When your taxes go up and the taxes of people like you go up too, then your relative bidding power is completely unaffected by that. Oh. And so the same penthouse apartments end up in the same hands as before. Money is free.
Money is free. Oh, that's so interesting.
We could invest in these pressing public purposes without having to demand any painful sacrifices from anyone. It's not natural for people to think in those terms, and it sounds like a snake oil claim, but it follows from a very simple premise, which is that beyond a certain point, further spending on bigger houses and bigger cars and more expensive wedding celebrations has no effect other than to raise the bar than what we consider adequate. That defines what we consider adequate.
So more money doesn't make us happier?
not when spent in those ways, when spent on things that make a real difference in people's lives, which would be not having to watch your loved one die in a corridor because there aren't hospital beds in the ICU. That makes a difference in the quality of people's lives. You know, not having climate refugees battling one another for the dwindling resources in the world, that would make a difference in people's lives. We know there are things we should be spending money on that would make a difference. But more expensive weddings, we're spending three times what we were in 1980 on wedding celebrations. Nobody's any happier because of that.
Well, and just to follow up on this, you, in a sense, offers us a choice. It's a kind of a A or B choice. So Society A is, as you describe it, it's a big house, a big wedding, as you said, fancy car, 2 weeks of vacation, low renewable energy, poor infrastructure, and low hospital surge capacity. Society B is a smaller house, less money on a wedding, a less fancy car, 5 weeks of vacation, a good infrastructure, 100% renewable energy, and high hospital surge capacity. I mean, it seems like Society B is one that we might find in Europe somewhere.
You know, there's a big academic industry that studies the determinants of human well-being, human flourishing. And that literature, which is now decades old, says conclusively that the society that spends more modestly on material things and has those other bases firmly covered has a better social safety net and greater public investment in infrastructure and surge capacity in hospitals, that society is going to be healthier and happier. There's no doubt about that. We don't get that society because there's a fundamental disconnect between what it is in your individual interest to do when it comes to spending and what it's in our interest as a society to do. The idea that individual interest always promotes the social good is a fiction. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. People stand to get a better view. Nobody sees any better than if everybody had remained comfortably seated. And if you bid for a more expensive house, one of the benefits you get is your kid goes to a better school. Why? Because the better schools are the ones that serve the more expensive neighborhoods. But if everybody bids for a more expensive house, half of all kids end up in bottom half schools, the same as before. So if we want to change that, we've got to vote for people who will allocate resources toward the things we know would make us better off, and steer them away from the spending categories that we know don't seem to matter for people.
Let me read an email from Zach. It's challenging to hear over and over that we as a people demand action from our legislature to bring forth policies to fight climate change. Shouldn't people make those changes by themselves and then create the actual demand for change instead of waiting for our government to enact policies that may not be what we want or need? Shouldn't we pressure the government to evolve by evolving ourselves? You're kind of saying that, Robert Frank.
Yeah, short answer, yes. Yeah, I once would have said no to that because I believed then and still believe that unless we have a stiff carbon fee dividend structure, unless we have massive investment in green energy, we really will not succeed in solving the climate crisis. But the message of the email is absolutely correct. If we take those steps ourselves, we will make it more likely that we will get those changes in policy.
Thinking about the crossroads that we are at right now, as we look at how this pandemic is just taking down our own economy, but economies all over the world, what will you be looking for? And obviously, it's our politicians, it's our elected officials who make policies and pass laws. And as you look into your very muddy crystal ball, what do you want? What do you want our leaders to do?
The federal government is going to be uniquely positioned to make a real difference in how successful we are in the next decade. We're going to soon be mired in the worst depression since the Great Depression. It may even be a worse depression than that one was. The economy is not going to bounce back on its own. what's magical is that in these conditions, the federal government has a printing press. It can print money. There are millions of people, as you pointed out of work. They need to be put to work. There are absolutely critical investments we need to make to battle climate and repair infrastructure and the like. We can hire those people who are out of work, put them to work doing tasks that really have for a long time needed desperately to be done anyway, and not worry a bit about kindling inflation, because we're in such a deep hole. It's both a supply shock. Nobody's making much of anything. They're not earning any income. It's a demand shock because they don't have any income. They're not able to go out and purchase things, which normally drives the economy. So we can pump the economy back to life by hiring people to build the things that we've long known we ought to be building.
One of the effects of this pandemic economy is that there are clearer skies. I mean, we're seeing some of the impact that if we were to cut back on fossil fuels, there is less CO2 being pumped into the atmosphere, that there might be an environmental benefit. And yet these two things seem to be on a collision course.
You know, I think what many people have discovered in the lockdown is that they're spending much less than before. And what we miss are contact with other people. I think the things that we are accustomed to buying, if nobody else is buying them, then you don't feel like you're missing out on anything. There's no fear of missing out on that score. And so we've sort of seen it made real in front of our eyes that spending less doesn't by itself make you less happy. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an insight that we can build on. We can say, if we're going to be spending more in the future, let's steer that spending toward the things that we know we should have been spending more on as we entered this crisis in the first place.
I do worry, though, about small businesses, just how they're going to survive if they do survive through all this.
You know, if we put people back to work, that's the key to getting restaurants and shops open. The reason they're not open yet is partly the fear of getting infected. People don't want to go out. But once we have a vaccine or a treatment, people will go out if they have the money. They're not going to have the money if we still have double-digit unemployment figures going forward. We need to put people back to work to keep those businesses afloat.
Do you think there'll be another pandemic once we get through this one?
Well, this one was forecast. This was the issue that kept George W. Bush up at night. It kept Bill Gates up at night. It kept Barack Obama up at night. They were warning and making plans for this. The current government undid much of that work, thinking it was money wasted. But yes, what we know is that there will be many more pandemics, possibly more serious ones than this one. But the real crisis is the climate crisis. I mean, if we did nothing about the pandemic, it would roar through the population and kill millions of people. But then it would be over until the next one, and we'd undergo these periodic crises. But the climate crisis is forever. You know, there's a recent study showing that if the CO2 level gets to a certain threshold, there will be no more cloud cover anywhere on the Earth. And if that happens, temperatures are going to rise 14 degrees centigrade more than they would have risen without that. So we're talking a true existential threat here. We know we need to spend money to do something about that, but we're not doing it.
Well, always interesting to talk to you, Robert Frank. Thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Yeah, so nice that you had me on. Yeah, I appreciate it.
And you're very welcome. And the book is called Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. And again, he's a professor of management and economics at Cornell University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out more about the program. And you can always download a podcast of the show. We've got many there for you to listen to. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.